Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Good day, everybody.
Adam, we have spent a lot of time together the last few days, and I love it.
Man, it's like 18, 20 hours a day, every day for like 5 days. Yeah, it's some quality time.
We are the Bell Lost Souls podcast, and we are talking about coming off the back of the Dallas Open, the U.S. event series, where there were many, many events, Warhammer 40,000, Age of Sigmar, Kill Team, Underworlds,
yep.
Paint and Takes, Open Gaming, Video Games, The Store, Spearhead demos, Age of Sigmar demos, a narrative event. It was a lot, and we streamed most of that. So
we did. Can I tell you about my favorite one?
Yes.
The Spearhead Blind Box. Oh, what an idea. And I wish. So there are many games out there, many other, mostly trading card games that do similar things. We have like a blind draft. But this, the fact that you could sign up for an event, a Spearhead, you know, Age of Sigmar event, and just rock up and just be given a box with a Spearhead in it. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe they were already built.
They were built and primed. Yeah.
Built and primed. And you didn't know which faction you were going to get. But it was just like, I'm going to, this is my faction for the new edition for Warhammer Reforged. I'm just going to buy a ticket, rock up, luck of the draw, this is who I am now. I thought that was just so freaking cool. And I want more of that stuff in the miniatures and tabletop space, because I think that is just such an awesome idea. And of course, you know, you go there with three or four mates, and if you get the faction you absolutely loathe, but one of your mates is their favorite, Lumineth, and you trade. Yeah,
you did. You bought your ticket, got assigned a table, went up there, and basically jammed something very special that nobody has done yet. And it was really cool. In this episode, we're going to talk about some Chaos Space Marine units in the upcoming Codex, which I think are pretty cool.
Yep.
Maybe touch on the Emperor's Children in a little bit.
Yep.
See how that slots in. And then the back half of the show, we'll talk about our experience there at the U.S. Open, and especially in regard to the Age of Sigmar stuff.
Correct, because both yourself and I, we had a chance to play Spearhead, play the brand new edition, and also pick the brains of some of the design team, talk to some of the best Age of Sigmar players in the world, and it taught me a lot, and it was really cool to play. And the reason I say Lumineth is because I got bad touched by Lumineth most of the weekend. Most of my practice games was practicing and sussing out the exhibition game we were happy enough to go and stream, which you should all go check out over on Twitch. It is one of the bestest, most excellent streams that Paul and I have ever done, which is saying a lot, because Paul and I have done a pie percentage of every stream that has ever been done for 40K. Paul and I have done a pie percentage.
We're
of that.
Included.
You could cut a slice of the pie.
Yeah.
We are included.
Yeah, included in that. It's really nice to be able to say that.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. That sentence came into my head, and I'm like, that's a truth. Yeah.
So Chaos Space Marines, you know, we got folks out there playing with them now. Like, it's a good faction now, and I really believe it's going to be a good faction soon again.
No doubt in my mind. This codex is so deep and so varied that this is going to be a codex that will keep players happy for years. Undoubtedly. And now we just got Emperor's Children slapped on the side, which I won't say is as expansive. It's actually quite a bit of a smaller pool to exist in. But I actually still think the list you can make from it, especially when you've taken the fact that you get to strap these two data sheets, which is just Lucius and the Noise Marines, into any of those detachments, really exciting. I think they're both quite nice.
Yeah, it's a weird one too, because, you know, we focus a lot on team tournaments. It's part of our play of what we do as a group. The way team tournaments run is typically they don't allow you to double up on factions. And there's been a lot of talk out there. Are they going to let people include Emperor's Children? Because it basically just lets you take a second Chaos Space Marine Codex.
Correct. So, you know, people, when you talk about the Emperor's Children index, people are like, oh, well, that's the same as like the Death Guard index or the Thousand Sun index. You know, it lives apart. But it functions entirely within the sandbox of the Chaos Space Marines Codex. So it is an interesting one. And we'll have to wait and see what TOs decide to do. I would say at a minimum, if they did allow it, you'd have to be different detachments, surely. Surely you couldn't just be like double up on the same detachment. But if that's where it goes, I think that's still really cool, because there are some that I think activate Emperor's Children a little bit more. And then, of course, if you were going to just fall back and play, and I'm not saying fall back, this isn't a fallback option, but Soulforged and take like a Vashtor a demon engine list alongside like maybe a Lucius, a bunch of noise marines, a bunch of legionaries list, and maybe some chosen, like an infantry, you know, transport mechanized Chaos Space Marines list. I think that sounds really cool in a lineup.
I'm glad you brought up Bastor. A lot of people out there are kind of considering Bastor as a go-to.
Well, it's the best model that's come out in like the last 18 months we didn't get to use, because it came out with rules that in 9th edition didn't make sense, but made a lot of sense for 10th edition. Because it had the different activating auras, like you had to pick a different aura, you know, so you could pick from a couple of different auras and stuff like that. And people like looked at it like, huh, is this what next edition looks like? And it looked more like a 10th edition data sheet than not. And it didn't really fit in the synergies package at the time. But now it really fits in very well. And the model is stunning. It is so cool.
It's got a weird look to it, you know, for sure, but it fits in with some of the stuff like you maybe would be taking with him anyway. Do you want to break out Fashtor's stats and we can kind of talk
yeah,
about
let's do it.
Things that go well?
So movement 12, toughness 10. He's got a 2-up armor, 4-up invulnerable, so 14 wounds, OC 3. So 2-up, 4-up, 10 wounds already is pretty, very durable. He is a very big model, so getting cover on Vashtor isn't too hard. His flamer weapon is anti-vehicle 4+. Lol, it's pretty funny. Is range 12, D6, torrent, strength 5, AP 2, 1 damage. So it wins any vehicles on a 4+, and of course most infantry on a 3 and or 4. In melee, it's got either 6 or 14 attacks. The 6 attack weapon has
sweep is what you're talking about there, right?
Yeah, apologies. Yeah, exactly right. Anti-vehicle 4+ on both, but the big sweep, big strike, has devastating wounds as well. So every 4+ is going to be straight through the save. 6 attacks hitting on 2s at strength 14, AP 2, 3 damage. So potential there to do 18 devastating wounds should all of them, you know, hit and all be 4+s against a vehicle. Then the hammer sweep is anti-vehicle 4+ as well. 14 attacks. Also hitting on 2s at strength 8, negative 0, 1 damage. So not super impressive, but if you run into orcs, you know, green tide, some boys, or endless swarm, which we saw on the top tables at Dallas, this will both be very, very, very good options, because he will instant kill any old truck. In fact, he'll have a decent chance, you know, with a couple little bit of softening to, you know, drop things like a Morkanaut and or a battle wagon. And then when the boys get out, 14 attacks in on 2s, winning on 3s, yeah, you'll smash those boys. And then Deadly Demise D3, Deep Strike as well. Deep Strike is quite nice. When a friendly, so this is the Unholy Mechanism Aura, when a friendly demon vehicle unit within 6 of this model, add 1 to the strength characteristic of weapons equipped by that model. So that isn't just shooting. That isn't just fighting. That is both. That is just +1 to strength in melee, +1 to strength on its range weapons as well, which is really cool. And then reordering reality. Each time an enemy unit within 18 of this model targets this model, to the end of the phase, that enemy unit's range weapons have hazardous. Now, this is quite cute. What do you think?
Yeah. Anytime you can kind of surprise folks with that, I think that's pretty good.
Exactly right. And there are some models out there that have like 2, sometimes 3 weapons each. And that means you're going to take 2 or 3 rolls each on the hazardous table.
What are some of your units you would take with Vashtor? Because I think that's the thing, is like you would apply that to the units that would be, you know, best suited to try to engage you.
So my first one was to look for the model that gets an exponential increase on every front from this, from Vashtor.
So like, and then Lord by extension,
yeah. Well, yeah, Lord of Skulls, absolutely, +1 strength. Not that I think he needs it. It's probably fine. My first point of call was the Venom Crawler. Straight up, Venom Crawler is, I think, 110 points, if I remember correctly, unless it went down recently just as the points got updated. But 110 points. So it's relatively cheap for toughness 9, 3-up armor, 5-up invulnerable save, and 9 wounds. What I love about that, being 9 wounds, it's under the bring it down bracket for something with 2 points for a kill on bring it down, rather than you know, more and more for the, you know, going from 10 or more, 15 or more, etc. And so it actually doesn't reward that much. So if you take a couple of Venom Crawlers and people bring it down against you, that could actually be a little bit of a trap.
Even you're talking about when people, I think, well, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're talking about if you take a bunch of vehicles and then folks take fixed objectives against you.
Correct. So someone's going to look at your army of demon engines and be like, well, if I can kill 2 of those a turn, that's great. And then they kill a Venom Crawler and you're like, congrats on the 2 points, mate. And they're like, huh? And you're like, yeah. But the reason I say the Venom Crawler is that it's cheap. Across the board, it's kind of, I suppose it's kind of middling, but it has that means because it's medium potency in all ways, like it's medium durability for a vehicle. It's Excruciator Cannon, which it has two, range 36, six shots each, so 12 shots at strength 6 minus 1, 2 damage. Going to strength 7 is a nice breakpoint. That means all your Terminators, all your Mega Knobs, all those things, you went on threes instead of fours. And a strength 6 to strength 7 is a strength 5 to strength 6 and strength 6 to strength 7 is actually one of the most important breakpoint bands to operate in for offensive profile. And then in combat, another 6 attacks at the same profile, 6, negative 1, 2. And then at the end of the fight phase, if one or more attacks made by this model in this phase destroyed one or more enemy units until the end of the battle, plus 1 attacks for the model's weapons. So that is pretty cool. So you can kind of ramp up your Venom Crawler running around, picking up scouts, picking up little bits and pieces everywhere. People's got two Crusaders or some Crute Hounds. This thing's perfect for that. But Vashtor lets this guy go to another level. In addition to the rest of the Soulforge Warpack bundle detachment, you know, what you get in there also really soup this guy up as well. So he's one of my, like, this is a medium platform at a good price point that I can take to 11 out of 10 because it takes every buff that I can put on this guy and just uses it really well.
Yeah, it doesn't overexpose you to these choices. Like, we actually saw players at events take very close, you know, fixed objectives. So they see a certain amount of vehicle saturation.
Yep.
Like, this is what I'm doing. That's the default.
We saw a mirror match of fixed objectives, didn't we? We streamed a game where both players took Bring It Down and Deploy Talibon Homers against each other. And that was funny as hell.
Well, I mean, again, if the points are there for you to get, your opponent's kind of had no choice but to bring it to you, then
that's
a good choice. And that's actually one of the struggles that I have, is like knowing when to reliably go to, you know, take secondaries like that, to fix secondary objectives instead of just flipping cards.
Having the confidence is a big deal, and getting to that confidence point, and also building a list that allows you the choice. So there are some armies that will just always have a good option for fixed secondaries. I'm talking like Eldar. I'm talking like Imperial, like Astra Militarum, Space Marines. Usually will have options for good fixed objectives. You know, playing with your scouts, playing with just a level of
going into corners and that kind of stuff. And
yeah, a level of disposable utility unit will be taken in a good competitive list, and you'll just be able to do those by default. And it's always the factions that, you know, kind of don't have those able, but then building them in so you have them when you want to. And I think that's the confidence. Having the confidence to take a little bit of offensive output away from your army and put in some utility units that allow you to, you know, activate this different way to play.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, part of where my hesitation comes with picking those fixed secondaries is the fact that sometimes it is a trap. Like, you do give your opponent a bunch of information for them to then react to. But in this case, you could be trapping yourself because the points you're planning to make are not as many.
So. Yeah, for sure. And there are some that are obvious, I guess. Like, if you're playing against Thousand Sons, if I'm playing against Thousand Sons, all their damage comes from their characters. So they're going to have to expose characters in order to wield their army. And so if I take Assassinate versus them, it feels really good because, well, if they choose to deny me Assassinate, they're choosing to play extremely passively and probably let me get a good primary score. So it's kind of like, well, that works for me as well. I'm getting my way either way.
If you can get 15 a turn, you know, then you're doing all right.
But then you go and pick Assassinate versus Gene Stealer Cult, and you never get line of sight on a character the entire game.
I can see how that would feel a little rough.
It would, because of course they you got like 20 neophytes in a unit, and of course you have the bundle of special weapons, which is all the unit really cares about, and they deploy in the open, in line of sight, and then trailing all the way back to absolute certain safety is the Primus in the unit that's like down the road, around the corner, and you're like, dang.
Yep, I'm feeling you. So I did bring up the Lord of Skulls. So can we bring up?
Oh, you did indeed, my dude. And talk about just a house. Has always been a house. Will always be a house.
Well, so we've seen players. It's either, you don't often see just one Lord of Skulls in a list. It's two or more.
It is. I mean, I think I'm down for the single now. I think world leaders have been making good use of these in some skewed lists, like double Lord of Skulls and Angron is just a lot to deal with. Of course, and you're a big proponent of saying, you know, read your player pack, have an idea. If you're going to take a model like this, can I take one and deploy it in safety, or can I take one and, you know, it has more than one way to get into the game, like more than one way to ingress into the middle of the board. But the Khorne Lord of Skulls, movement 8, toughness 13, which is, oh, so good. 3+ armor save, 4+ invulnerable save, 24 wounds, objective secured 8, of course. It's Khorne, baby. It's moving 8, 8 OC, hilarious.
All reasonable.
Yep. It comes with a, you know, your player's choice of what you would like to shoot with. And I don't know really where the best options are, because there is a lot of good ones here. I do like the Hades Gatling Cannon with sustained hits 1, 12 shots at strength 8, minus 2, 2. I think that's quite a good fallback option. Icor Cannon, 2d6 shots blast at 7, 2, 2. But I think the Gore Storm is my favorite, but also like the Demon Gore as well. Actually, they're all good. Skull Hurler, 2d6 shots, not blast, which I think is quite cute. And the reason that's cute is because you get to shoot it into combat. Strength 14, minus 3, 3 damage. I mean, when you roll the snakes, you're going to feel like, oh, wow, I could have had any other gun. But when you roll 12, it's going to be a good time. The Demon Gore Cannon, I think, is the one you kind of you want a lot of the time. This is the strength 14, minus 4, d6 plus 2, and is d6 blast. So it can really pop off. And then the last one, the Gore Storm Cannon, d6 plus 3 at 24 inches. This one is suppose the most universally good. Strength 10 is very good against heavy, medium, and light infantry. Good against light vehicles as well.
Yep.
Negative 2 is very fine. And then flat 3 damage is exceptionally good. In combat, you can have... Why is it not a derivative 8? I do not know. But it's got 5 attacks at strength 16, derivative of 8, minus 4, derivative of 8, and 8 damage, turn 8. So happy days. And then the sweep
is... That's just
is,
8.
Yes, just 8. And then the sweep is 15 attacks at strength 8, minus 2, 2 damage, which is one of the best sweeps in the game for that profile. Strength 8, minus 2, 2 damage with 15 attacks is absurd. It does explode for D6 plus 2.
Could have been 16.
Yeah. Could, exactly. Well, that's what I was about to say. Why is it not 16 at least? D6 plus 2 deadly demise, and you just know this thing has a platform akin to a large ruin. A footprint, rather. And then plow through the enemy in the fight phase after this model has finished making its attacks. If this model destroyed one or more enemy units this phase, each enemy unit within 6 of this model must take a battle shock test.
Oh, yeah. I mean, battle shock becoming more and more relevant. Like,
yeah, the timing there is good because let's say you have a big, you know, pile on the middle and we're just going to be brawling in the middle kind of matchup. This guy activates, you know, charges and activates first, and then you can battle shock the other adjacent, you know, of course you maneuver so you get enough things within range, because there's like this, maybe there's like 2 units in the game that this guy charges and doesn't kill, especially with Dark Pacts. So you can have like lethal or sustained on those 15 attacks.
Oh, it has the keywords for it too.
Oh, it does indeed, mate. And I did assume that it did.
But, you know, I think that's a thing is when you're going through the codex, sometimes you start to want to layer on all these special rules and you find out what can and can't, you know.
Correct. Always important to do. This one of the first things you can do is when you select the detachment that you kind of think you want to take, make sure like the keystone pieces that you are constructing this thing around actually function in that package, so they actually get the bonuses. But the reason I like player through the enemy is because you make those charges with this guy, of course, activate here first, go nuts, tank shock if you want, strength 15, strength 16, absolutely wild, and then you trigger the battle shocks. And if you trigger the battle shocks appropriately, and within this codex there are a bunch of ways to negative your opponent's leadership for the battle shocks, and then if you battle shock them, they can't interrupt, they can't armor of contempt, they can't, you know, do a bunch of things that would allow them to, you know, interrupt or negate your profile as well, or your attacks.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. I'm glad you brought up the stuff earlier, you know, going back a bit about terrain types and deployment. You would hate to Well, let's just say when you have big models like this, putting them
Yeah.
into every deployment zone can be sometimes tricky based on how the terrain is set up, and then you wouldn't want to basically kind of like choke your own ability to get through and interact with the table because
Well,
you didn't know that.
I've got a wonderful event in a small border town called Narracourt coming up in a couple of months. It's called TerraCon. It's one of Australia's longest running tournaments, and one that I have won in the past. Thank you very much.
Nice, congratulations.
I'm looking to kind of like just run a fun list. And by fun list, I really want to run a Baneblade. It has been so long since I ran a Baneblade chassis. I'm not sure which one I want to take of the
I
six
was
that
going to
I
ask, like
own.
an actual Baneblade or
It
something.
might end up being an actual Baneblade. If I'm in for a pound, in for a penny, in for a pound, and I'll do an actual OG Baneblade, the real deal. But the first thing I did when I was considering this is after I wrote a list and I'm like, oh yeah, I'd be happy to play this for, you know, five or six games. That sounds like some fun. Even though, you know, it's got some strong elements, you know, tank commanders and the other things. No indirect fire, thank you very much. But I messaged the TO and was like, okay, I'm thinking of taking a Baneblade. Blink twice if it's a stupid idea for your terrain setup. So I didn't ask him to be like, tell me with absolute certainty that I can use this and it's going to be a good plan. Just tell me if, or like, you know, what density of terrains can I expect? Because I looked through the players pack and they just said they're going to be running Games Workshop standard terrain. And I'm like, are you running the exact maps or are you just running those terrain rules? Because if it's the exact maps with all the plexiglass or the outlined squares and stuff, actually make things a little bit awkward because essentially the Baneblade can't shoot through those unless it gets its entire base on it. And the base of the Baneblade is bigger than the terrain pieces, so
Creates a
it's
little,
even
you know, a
smaller.
little awkwardness.
So I just asked him straight up, like, are you going to have the plexiglass outlines on all your bases and all the stuff? And it's like, yeah, like the majority of the main ruins in the middle of the board will 100% have the, you know, are likely to have the outlines. Some won't, some ifs, some buts. And so he said, yeah, bring it if you want. I can't guarantee you it's always going to be a good time, but you should be able to use it satisfactorily. I'm
It's
like,
like, well,
perfect,
when they
man.
fail
Thank you
that
very much.
charge,
Yeah.
man,
So
they're out there rolling over.
didn't give me any certainties that it's going to be you 100% never a downside, because of course always taking a big model like that. And it didn't give me any information that no one else is able to get. But I was able to ask him, and you know, hopefully he would have been honest and said, yeah, it's going to be pretty dense, man. That might be a rough day at the office. And of which case I would have been like, thank you very much, sir. I will deliberate.
Yeah, quickly before we jump back to the codex, is that every tournament organizer I've ever met, you know, for the most part, just wants you to have a good time, and they want you to have as
Exactly
much
right.
information as you possibly can to enable you to have a good time without, you know, empowering you more than any other attendee. So.
Yeah. I mean, above and beyond anything, you are essentially a customer of that tournament, of that event. Like going to a concert, going to anything else. You buy a ticket to a movie, you expect to see the movie. But more than that, TOs are your mates. They're your community members, and you know, they want you to have the best time possible. No one wants their mates going away from something that they put probably 100 hours of blood, sweat, and tears in, and probably aren't getting any money, to have their mates come and not have a good time. You know, if you invite your friends over for dinner and you serve them something that they don't want to eat, that's the worst thing imaginable,
It
you
is.
know?
Completely agree. So, staying with the Bash War theme, Obliterators. I can kind of consider Obliterators.
Oh, especially now that they went down in points, because I believe they went down. I can't remember if it was 5 or 10 points, but the fact they went down at all is very exciting. I think they are an extremely good and palatable unit now. I really like them in the Fellhammer, which is the pseudo Iron Warriors kind of list, because
And
I
the
think
reason
they
you're
get
saying pseudo Iron Warriors, I mean, not to take us back, it has been a week or so since we
correct.
did this, but like the way the detachments work now is that they kind of ring of what the Legion you may have expected them to be, have a play
Yeah.
style or seem like they have rules that
Well,
slot against that play against that Legion very well, but are not limited to just that.
in addition, it works with the fluff. Over 10,000 years, these veterans of the Long War have, you know, grown and developed different ideologies of battle. They've had to evolve to survive. It's not only in the Eye of Terror, but also, you know, against a growing Imperium and or extremely multitude of Xenos, which they thought they all had conquered. But it turns out they, you know, they ended a bit early. So they're making these detachments that echo the flavor of what you might attach to a certain legion or a certain chapter, or whatnot, but without having to say so much and commit you to to playing it that way.
I
So they're
love it. It's
letting it
so it
be, yeah.
empowers everyone with it with a big collection, or maybe like the color scheme, which like the play style of a different army. Well, then, you know, now you're even more seemingly encouraged to follow that dream.
Well, straight up, like even the Iron Warriors in the Horus Heresy had bikes, had jump pack troops, had you know, lightning strike fighters. They had, it was a fully fledged legion. And to think that they, you know, over 10,000 years would lose all that, but still maintain so strong this ideology of this one way of attrition warfare, I think it's a misnomer. I think it's more likely that they would become more diverse and have to evolve even further into different spheres of war to survive for 10,000 years than it is to be like, well, we lost all the planes and the bikes, I guess we're just dudes on foot walking it. Yeah.
That's a great point.
That, well, at least that's in my head canon, you know, kind of me putting myself in that space.
So obliterators.
Obliterators. Beautiful toughness of 7. Absolutely fantastic place to be. I apologize. I scrolled up to the Fellhammer because I was drooling over it for a moment there. So quick by time. No, they have triple modal guns. So they have one gun that has 3 modes and 3 ways to fire, which I don't know if you, we were doing this show back in 8th edition. Yeah. When people, we started having these dual modal guns.
Yeah.
And you and I both said, always a good place to be. If you don't know which gun you want, look for the one that does 2 things. The missile launches, the Tempest launches for Eldari and whatnot, whichever one they were. But the flesh metal guns come in three spicy flavors. Focused Malice is melter 2, D3 shots at strength 12 minus 3, 4 damage. So the fact that they're melter 2, but I have like more strength than a melter or a multi-melter, I think it's really cool. Only issue is they're 18 inch range, so you can't hit that melter 2 off the deep strike, but it is what it is. The Ruinous Salvo is blast, D6 shots at strength 8 minus 2, 2 damage. I think that's the one you're going to use like most of the time.
That seems because that is good.
It's just good against everything. And then especially seeing as they have packed, so you can have lethal or sustained on the D6s. And with blast, you can really just pop off. And then the last one is Warp Hail, which comes with sustained hits 1. So you can dark pact for lethal and have the goodness of both. Now, the trick is this isn't blast, but it's D6 plus 3 shots at strength 5 minus 1, 1 damage. So it actually is a pseudo little, you can almost look at it like a flamer almost, but it does roll to hit, but it does have D6 shots with blast. So minimum 4 up to 9 shots. They are, like I said, toughness 7. They're 2 plus armor, 5 plus invulnerable save, 5 wounds, and 2 objective control. And then once per battle, this is their warp ripped firepower. When this unit makes a dark pact, it can use this ability. If it does, until the end of the phase, ranged weapon equipped by models in this unit have indirect fire. So real spicy.
I like that, especially we were just talking about the density of terrain. And you want density of terrain, by the way. That's not a bad thing.
But no, not at
things
all.
That can deal with it and not lose a ton of rounds.
Yeah. I mean, with the tables we're playing on at the moment, I would like to say one thing. I'll go on a soapbox and say 10th edition, the terrain tables, even in the multitude of different formats that we have, because there's still quite a few different terrain formats, we're getting to a place where they're all fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, there's none that just say fire shooting is dead. There's none that just say, oh, melee's dead. There's terrain formats that are, they're pretty well rounded for a multitude of different armies and different archetypes. And you know, back to what I was saying about the Baneblade. I mean, those tables that are bad for the Baneblade are great for Lehman Russes. So like I would not be saying like, oh no, woe is me, I can't take any tanks. It's just like, I can take a bunch of really good tanks or one awesome tank that is just so big, it gets it its own way. And me as a player and as a general, I got to take those into account.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also you're looking for like efficiency. You don't want to have too many games to where where it feels like you cannot participate the way that you want your list to participate.
I don't want to bring a quarter of my army in one tank and then feel like I brought a paperweight that doesn't get into the game, you know?
Yeah, that doesn't work in half games. Yeah, so it's fine to ask. I think it's...
Oh, for sure. I encourage people. I encourage people. Like, you know, if you have a really cool list you want to play, make sure you're going to have fun with it. Make sure you're going to have fun time. I'm committing to playing, you know, 6 games with this. Oh, 5 games with this. I can't remember if it's 5 or 6. But, you know, that's 3 hours each. If it's a 5-rounder, that's 15 hours I'm going to be running that Baneblade. And you know, I want to make sure that at least a good portion of that is going to be an enjoyable experience.
I think it's very understandable.
Yeah. Crushing Fists. This always surprised me. So pour one out, everybody, if you do own any Mutilators, because the Mutilators, you know, the say what you will about the model, it came out of a certain vintage and is now no longer with us, because essentially we had Obliterators and Mutilators, and maybe some listeners right now are too young to remember this, but the Technovirus came in 2 flavors. It made you spicy punchy or spicy shooty.
Yeah.
But now the Obliterators punch really good as well. Four attacks each, hitting on threes with strength 9, minus 2, 2 damage. Like, say, are they actually crump?
Yeah, that's good. And yeah, why'd you have to bring up mutilators?
I know. It was, I believe, for the best. So the people who loved mutilators, like all 6 or 7 of them.
I don't know anyone who loved the mutilators.
I don't know anyone either.
I don't believe I've ever played against them. I mean, like ever.
I had a mate who played with a couple of singles because you used to be able to take him in units of one, and he would just chuck him out on objectives and be like, well, this is just annoying to kill, right, for some armies. And he would just take like two singles and use them like Chaos Spawn with 2-up armor saves, essentially. And that's it. That's all I saw of them for, like, since 5th edition. I haven't seen in 5th edition, trying to think. But yeah, it's suffice to say, take what was good about Mutilators, add it to Obliterators, make one good unit rather than having one super, you know, Obliterators were kind of awkward for a long time. Either they were extremely good or extremely bad. And now you've got one well-rounded model unit with a brand new awesome model. And by brand new, I mean like it's 5 years old. Still feels
it's
new to
plastic,
me.
It's plastic. It looks great. It's got a good size to it.
Exactly right. It's plastic and it looks cool. And yeah, I think that's a much better design philosophy.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. Take some cultists with some dark communes and a bunch of demonic engines and go to work.
Yeah. And warp talons. Do not forget the warp talons.
Let's talk about the warp talons before we take a break.
Might be the best unit in the book. Like just without any buffs or any detachment, if you just like evaluate who's got the best data sheet, warp talons might be it. They are fantastic. Movement 12. Toughness 4, 2 wounds, 3+ armor, comes with a 5+ invulnerable save, which is very nice. Objective secured 1, not a big deal. In combat, each one will have 4 attacks, essentially with twin lightning claw profile, hitting on 3s, strength 5, minus 2, 1 damage, twin linked, so rerolling to wound. So, you know, a unit of 10 pops 40 attacks out with dark pacts. So, you know, either lethals or sustained, unless you're wounding on 6s, I think sustained is a better way to go because then it's, you know, at worst it's 5s re-rolling, which I think is very good on the wound side rather. And then they have deep strike, of course, and dark pacts. And at the end of the fight phase, if this unit was eligible to fight this phase, so if it made a charge, 100%, and is not within engagement range of one or more enemy units, it can you can remove this unit from the battlefield and place it into strategic reserve. Now, where this gets really spicy is when you look at the mechanics of this. So let's say I put out a unit of Croot Hounds onto an objective for the purpose of screening, and maybe I had area denial or something like that. I, the Chaos player, I'm playing against Tau, and if I put out a significant unit, it's going to get significantly shot and dead. So I use my warp talons, smack them out 12 inches, make a charge, kill the unit, and go straight back into reserve. So I did not expose any, I did not actually, as long as I get the charge, essentially, and kill the Croot Hounds, I did not actually expose anything to your opponent's fire. And then in their next turn, you rapid ingress them back onto the table in an inopportune position for your opponent.
Like behind some of this terrain we keep talking about, rapid ingress is the strategy, and they'll let you come in at the end of your opponent's movement phase on their turn.
Correct. Well, you think about how you'd have to play against an army that takes a couple of units of these. You'd have to keep your front line screened. Well, what ends up happening is they eat the screens without getting shot. And so they activate all your other assets in addition to actually just being a house and a bunch of good quality attacks with the vast majority of profiles out there. So you think as a tower player, like, oh, cool, I'll chuck out a breacher, a unit of breaches or a unit of pathfinders to screen. The warp talons come out, eat the unit, go back into reserve. Next turn, you put out another screen, warp talons, rapid ingress 9 inches away from that unit, outside cover, move 12, auto charge, kill the unit, go back into reserve. And all you're doing is losing units with nothing to, and you can't do anything about it. And so warp talons are, I think, a very big skill check, firstly, for generals out there playing Chaos Space Marines. Using warp talons well, not letting them get shot, keeping them safe and getting the mileage out of them is going to be a big deal. And in addition, it's going to be a pain for all of us trying to figure out what to do, because I think that means, like, if you, let's say, same example as the tower player, you have to scream with the devilfish. You have to scream with something that won't get
lightning clawed down by a few attacks.
Exactly right. A single activation of warp talons doesn't automatically kill it. They still might kill it, mate. Like, they still legitimately might kill it. 40 attacks, like, depending on what detachment you're in.
Think of the higher toughness, and you'll get an armor save.
Yeah, spot on. Or things that have like a 2-up save or have a 3-up save with armor contempt and a good amount of wounds can survive these guys' profile. But as for your small skirmishing units, these guys eat them for breakfast. No, not even breaking a sweat.
Good to know. All right, we'll take a break and we'll come back and talk a little bit about the Age of Sigmar stuff that we know about so far,
Ooh,
which is a
yeah.
little bit. We know a little bit.
We do. We can sit here as people who having had played the game, which I think is quite cool. We don't know a lot about a lot of different factions because we were given the modus operandi of studying a couple. But man, it's going to be a good time.
All right. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. Thank you so much for joining us for the second part, talking about Sigmar. Thanks to the Patreons. Thanks to our sponsors. It is a pleasure to be doing this and hanging out with y'all. So this past weekend, we did most of the commentary was around the Warhammer 40,000 event, like tournaments.
Yes.
You actually made reference to it. Tyranids end up taking the whole thing down. I don't think anyone would have picked that.
No. And specifically Endless Swarm Tyranids. So like the most intensive, busy, lots of stuff. Endless, unending stuff.
Well, it's confusing because it's the unending swarm.
I know.
Detachment.
I know. Yeah.
And there's an endless swarm stratagem that's not in that detachment.
Yeah, it's in the invasion fleet, I believe, which is very funny.
It is. But there's a lot of swarm stuff with Tyranids, and we got to see it put on, you know, very well.
Exactly right. Now, the reason it worked, and I suppose this is kind of like a weird microcosm. You and I analyze the meta, and we talk about what's working and what's not out there. But orcs are here in a big way. And interestingly enough, it's elite orcs. It's Bully Boys Detachment elite orcs that is kind of the big feared boogeyman at the moment, or bully boogie. Boys, snare drum, please, snare drum, let's go. And so the thing is about them that they go through, you know, knights, space marine chassis, things like that, like butter. They just carve them up. But they only have a small amount of high-quality attacks, especially for orcs, like a unit of mega knobs on the war turn will have
which is now limited each. To just six. Like you can't have 10 or whatever.
You can't, 10, man. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's only three attacks each. So it's only 18 attacks from a full unit of six mega knobs. Guess what? That doesn't kill 20 gargoyles.
Yeah.
I'm going to have at least two dudes left if you hit with everything, wound with everything, which they won't, obviously. Yeah, they hit on fours or threes. They hit on threes if they got a war boss. And so, you know, they have stratagems for rerolls to hit and like, totally fine. You're still probably going to make it through that with 20 guys. And so the idea behind the Endless Swarm was to just take more bodies than they have attacks and then use the fact that you can recycle or recursion on your squads for 2 CP. And you have surge moves to lock off the board. So anytime you get targeted, you get to surge towards them. And then just like drown the objectives and don't let them score. And it worked. It worked against two of the, I would say, best orc players at the event. Players who have, you know, won majors before and who, you know, some have represented their country at the international level. And the Endless Swarm went through both of them, both of those Bully Boys lists. And you got to see it in the final. It was an extremely good game, extremely close game, played extremely well. Can I extract extremely any more? Yes, I can. And you should go check that out.
Justified,
because it came down to the bottom of turn five, last quarter, card draws. It was literally neck and neck up until the last turn. And the Tyranid player needed to flip literally two cards off the top of his deck to win the game by a couple of points. Even if one of those cards didn't flip, I think he was going down by 2 points. Like, he needed to get minimum of three, I think 3 points off each card, or 5 and 3 or 5 and 2 or whatever, off the two cards off the top of his deck. And he got both and was able to, due to having, you know, just stuff everywhere and recurring and coming back on the table, he was able to go and, you know, get the win by a couple of points. It was really, really hard fought. Well done to the orc player. Played extremely well, literally put himself in the driver's seat, had every ability to win that game. But yeah, Endless Swarm took the day, and I'm pretty happy to see it. And I will say, as an analyst of the meta, while Endless Swarm is extremely good into Bully Boys, there's a couple of other orc detachments that they're not good into at all. Like, you talk about the Green Tide, and you know that the gif, like, I'm you but better.
Yeah.
So you both have endless stuff, except one of them does damage and absolutely crumps in combat, and the other one doesn't do anything. So yeah, that is definitely a meta adjustment that all players may have to look into.
We'll see what people
or not.
Do. But yeah, so we talked a lot about 40K over the course of the weekend. We also talked about the new Age of Sigmar, the fourth edition Age of Sigmar stuff. And maybe, you know, we talk a little bit about Spearhead. Spearhead is that other way to play. You might think of it as like the Age of Sigmar like combat patrol.
Yeah, correct. Correct. It's the it's not the entry level. It's the boxed game. It's like if you want to just have a taste of Age of Sigmar, or if this is what you have time or a budget for, here's an excellent way to enjoy this rule set in its own little self-contained world with its own little subset of rules. Really cool rules as well. Really well balanced.
That's like, what I want to say is that it's not Combat Patrol, but think about it that way. You have this collection, this one set collection of figures mm-hmm. that you then play, and you're playing it on a board, and you're playing the core rules, but how the game is played is a lot different.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. And the biggest difference I found was the reactive stuff. Like, so you draw cards to delineate your battle tactics, you know, which just like in a full-sized game of Age of Sigmar. You're playing on a little bit of smaller board. But what I will say is, despite having a smaller board and still having five objectives on it, it doesn't feel like clumped up. Doesn't feel like there's nowhere to move. Doesn't feel like, you know, the only options you have is to go straight at your opponent. It feels really well constructed. Like, they have put a significant amount of thought and effort into making this game feel like a fully fledged standalone game with its own tactics and maneuvers and way to play, its own like playbook.
Is that you mentioned the size of the board. You are playing on a smaller board. It's like it's kind of like a Kill Team board.
In size.
I don't know the exact measurements, so you know, don't quote me on that, but it's about that size of board, and there are printed objectives on there, each with a different symbol on them, and your battle tactics or, you know, the twists or whatever will sometimes reference the objectives with the specific pictures on them, and you may have to, you know, adjust your tactics based on whatever it is those points are available to you. And in addition to this, you may think short board, like big people are moving and charging all the time. Well, most of the factions have abilities to kind of move around the board, like either through magic or reoccur after one unit gets taken out, maybe one unit can come back. We've got the reinforcements rule.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of your, you know, your mainstay, you know, battle line core infantry, you know, clan rats or Liberators. Liberators.
Yep.
You know, things like that, things you think would be the core, you know, frontline infantry troops, a lot of those recur. So when they die, they come back. And so it's a very, well, we were told by some of the designers that it's a very good tactic to get your infantry up, stuck in early, getting value, and then back on the table early. So, you know, if they go in, score you some battle tactics, you know, kill a couple of models and die, that's kind of a perfect world. Then they come back the next turn and they get back into the fight, which I think is really cool and a really good way of doing it. But what really got me is that, so you'll draw your battle tactics cards, and at the top, it'll tell you how to score the points for the battle tactic. But then at the bottom, it'll have a special ability, a reactive thing that you can do in your opponent's turn. Now, you can either choose to hold on to the battle tactic, of course, after your turn, because you didn't score it. But then if you didn't score it, and you chose not to because you're a spicy savanti general, because the ability is really good, you can totally do stuff to inject your will into your opponent's game plan by reactive move, countercharging at the end of their combat phase, or the end of their charge phase, rather. And I think it's just really cool. Like, one of the things people are going to have to get used to is at the end of every phase, let's say I'm the active player, I say to Paul, "You got anything spicy to do?" And Paul looks at his card and he's like, "Not yet." I'm like, "Dang, it's coming. He's gonna do something crazy." And then it's not quite a game of Gotcha Hammer either, because all these things are available to everybody. The same deck of cards is mirrored on both players, so anything they could have, you could have. And so they're not really gotchas as of yet. It's just like, I have to take into account that this is a ever evolving game that can change on a knife edge, and it makes it really exciting. Like, really exciting.
I agree. And then when you factor in, and granted, the units behave much like they do, or you would expect them to do, but, you know, once you get used to how the units work, you'll be doing all their tricks. Like, for instance, you know, I was playing with Sylvaneth. I like Sylvaneth. And, you know, the Tree Lord had some cool effects they could do. Sometimes they can shoot into combat. Sometimes they can jump through pieces of terrain to teleport across the tabletop. Sometimes they heal. You know, you're playing a full experience with a set number of models, set number of units, and over the course of about 40 minutes. Like I felt like I was always doing something.
Yeah, same. I never felt bored. I never felt like I didn't have options. I never felt like I had anything that, like, I was just a participant or I was passive. I always felt like I had agency and I had. But it's so what I love is like even in the I think I played 5 or 6 games or maybe it was 7 games. But what I love is you have a card and your opponent knows you're hanging onto that card. And they know you're going to get up to something. And then watching them try and play around what you may or may not have, that's the upper tier of this game. That's the upper tier. What could they have?
I wasn't there yet in my games. I was just jamming points. Yeah. I just looked at it. Like, what can I do
just send
this
it.
Turn to get these 3 points?
Just play it like a Death Company. Horus is everywhere. Every objective. Everyone must die.
That was pretty much it. Yeah, I did feel pretty... I felt like the Sylvaneth were going to be pretty strong also. It's a big
Yeah, well, I played exclusively with the Skaven. Because I wanted to. New models, let's go. I gotta say, new rat ogres look amazing. Oh, those, the differentiation of textures and the different stances and things like that, really good job. And so, yeah, I was playing pretty much exclusively with the Skaven, trying to get as many reps as I could with the one faction, because that's how I generally play. I don't try, when I'm trying to learn a game, I play the one thing until I've got a level of proficiency and an understanding, and then I'll move on to another thing or stick with it, whatnot. But yeah, I play exclusively with the Skaven, because of course, they're like, they're in the box. It's all about the Skaven, this edition and the Vermintide stuff. Skaven, and I wanted to get on that
boss,
train. Yeah, it is. Like, I wanted to get on the bells. I'm going to ring that bell. But yeah, they've got some really cool stuff. I will say though, is it the Vermin Lord? No, not the Vermin Lord. The hero on Norbeast, on the gruesome rat looking.
That's the
beastie.
Claw something.
Yeah, the Claw Fiend or whatever. And I probably still got that name wrong.
No, the Claw Lord. I can't remember what it is, but that's just.
Yeah, it's like Claw Lord on Gnarl Beast or something like that. And that model, absolutely phenomenal. Let me down every time. it took me like the third game to realize that, because I was playing most of these games where the starter set was versus the Stormcast, and the Stormcast Lord on the Dracosaur was going around and soloing units and stuff like that and doing a really good job. And I was like, my guy should be like that. And I was trying to go off and solo Stormcast units, and I was like, this guy's just not doing it. And I triple checked his profile. I'm like, yeah, you're using him wrong. I was just using him completely wrong for like the first 2 games. as soon as I started wrapping that guy in clan rats and then almost using that model as like the unit champion in the clan rats, I started annihilating. I started doing really well. Like, here's the clan rats and this is the guy that adds the punch to the clan rats, that was what was that started. It's and that's just like what you get when you play like 4 or 5 reps with the same thing. Whereas my first couple of games, I was like, why isn't this guy a big punchy, beastie on a thing? Like, he's not. He's like 2 heroes in a trench coat. You chuck him in on the flank of the.
Skaven are essentially cowards. You know that, right? They don't really want to be up there and.
110%. Actually, like there was a trait that I ended up putting on him where he actually started shooting really well and started blowing stuff up. So it was really, really cool.
Oh, nice. Well, I mentioned that having the core rules. I do like the fact there's this like this underdog mechanic.
In Reforged, yeah. I 100% agree. I think this is one of the coolest things that they've done.
No, even in Spearhead.
Oh, of course there is. Yeah, you are right.
Yeah, especially with the twist. And so if you're ever down in points, which is kind of how to determine if you're the underdog or not, there's ways to kind of keep you in it along the way. Mm. But it's not just some like a like a break glass at the end. It's some things you can do along the way to kind of keep the game close.
Yeah, I agree. It's like every turn there can be a little bit of extra to help you even the game up. I think it would be a great thing to port into 40K. I like the mechanic. I like the idea of that mechanic in 40K, to be honest. So maybe we'll see it at some point.
Yeah, they kind of borrow from each other every now and then.
Of course. I see them as both being test beds for each other and the evolution of game design and whatnot, constantly evolving, constantly trying to, give the players what they want, give them the experience that, hopefully we deserve, a good thematic, engaging battle between 2 players or more. And yeah, I think the underdog mechanic is a great step forward.
I agreed. And we see the core mechanics, of Sigmar changing a little bit. Everything's kind of getting shifted to an ability like even a fight ability, a move ability. And so I think that really helps codify like when things are supposed to happen. And so there's less ambiguity if there was any, but I think it gives you a system to slot even more cool things into like as the game evolves if they want to.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. So having talked to the design team for Age of Sigmar, who were awesome enough to be at Dallas and gave us some of their time, let us pick their brains so we could, you know, cast and give people, you know, true insights from the designers. We was informed that they have specifically tried to take away, and now I'm not an expert on the most recent edition of Sigmar, the third edition, some people are calling it. But there was a lot of emphasis put on combos and, you know, kind of layering on synergies on top of synergies on top of synergies on top of battle traits on top of the yada, yada, yada. And they're trying to refocus back to the core rules, as in, like, we want people to be focused on mastering movement phases, you know, getting the most out of their movement, shooting, fighting, charging, all these things, rather than just trying to make the best super units and stuff like that. Because I don't think it was quite at the stage where we would say that, you know, that we were playing with Death Stars and stuff over there. But there certainly was, you know, there was no need to focus on the rules because your army would just, you know, if you built your army correctly and then just played it logically, it just did everything. Whereas they want people to really try and excel. Like they, and I love this. I love this idea. They want people to really excel at the core mechanics of a fundamental tabletop game. And I think that is superb.
Yeah, I think that's a great spot and completely agree. And it seems like with the way that like combats work, you know, clearly define when things can shoot, what they can do, how to buff certain things. Yeah, I think this, we're kind of set up for what should be a pretty cool addition.
Yeah, and in extrapolating on what I said as well, one of the main reasons they're doing that is because they're trying to make, I think there's a big focus on making our games, which can, you know, from afar look extremely complex, extremely rules dense and hard to get into, a lot more engaging and interesting for new time players. I think Spearhead is just like leaps and bounds down that road. But man, even the color coding, just the little things like color coding all the rules to phases, like gold for hero phase, etc., etc. I can't remember which one silver is, but silver's in there and blue's green. Yeah, but all I remember is gold, because it's the first thing I've got to do. The first is gold. Gold is first. And so these are the things I was chanting to myself while I was, you know, playing my first couple of games. It just makes it very simple. And then they've even, I probably said this in the cards campaign, but I will continue to champion this because I think it's awesome. They've put symbols on them as well, because there are people in their community who are colorblind. And if you are colorblind, you can see you can look for the symbol for which phase is which activation, and not just for the colors.
That. Yeah. It is both symbols and colors. And I think that is something that is going to help people. And plus also, you know, when you're learning the game for the first time.
Yeah.
Or let's take it even further. Maybe you've already mastered the game and you want to reduce what your like mental load is.
Yeah, correct.
Having some of this color coding and symbols actually mean something, I think, is pretty good times.
100%. And I love it personally because, I mean, you and I, we've played many editions of Warhammer 40K. There's been times where I've played factions that have access to, you know, 30 stratagems, you know, in a single turn. I can use any of these. I love the idea that I could look at my book of stratagems, so to speak. You know, this is just me trying to put it in 40K speak for some people. And I would be like, okay, I'm in the shooting phase, open up my book of stratagems, and then all I have to look for is the color of the shooting phase. And then I know which one of my options. Rather, because I've done this at tables in previous editions, where I've cracked open my, you know, double praise or even triple played spread of available stratagems for my army, and then it's been going to look for, spending 5 minutes being like, where are all the ones that I can use in the shooting phase? I can use that one, I need that one, No, that's assault phase.
That can't be the worst. Yeah, when you're like desperate for
correct. But now you just look for your color. You just look for your color. Bada bing, bada boom. Then you got your options. You nail your options down from the 30 down to the 3, so to speak.
Yeah, love it. I'm looking forward to playing. I mean, absolutely. And I think that with both Spearhead, it's an easy way to get your hands on it and see if you like the core mechanics, and then take it from there. If you're not normally a Sigmar player, if you are a normal Sigmar player, I believe that you're really going to enjoy the new edition.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, it's designed from the ground up, you know, to make it, you know, easier to interact with.
Yeah, it really is. It possibly might be one of the most easy to digest, you know, rules from Games Workshop in a long time. And it, you know, Spearhead leads into the main game. So if you just are brand new, you know, pick up a Spearhead box or two of your, you know, associated faction, give it a couple of games with your mates, and it's such a great platform to build from one game to the other, like to feed into, you know, Age of Sigmar and Spearhead. They it's a circle. They feed off each other.
All the factions I won't speak for you, but the factions that I saw, they seem to really capture the element of that faction.
Yeah. They are the thematic nature of things. Like, they've really done well, you know, building the fluff in. I think it's really cool.
Nice, man. Well, that's our show this week. Anything else? Any parting impressions from Sigmar, the event, or anything you want to share?
I think there's just huge amount of exciting stuff to delve into on the Sigmar front. I'm in awe of how well the design team have put this together. And yeah, hopefully you guys are excited as we are, because I think it's just going to be a stupendous couple of years when this new game launches in full capacity. And seriously, if you are at all Sigmar curious, jump in and play some Spearhead. Like, it is a fantastic in its own game. You do not need to go any further. Just pick up a Spearhead box, jump in, give it a crack. And there isn't, so maybe there's one or two lines that are still holding out for new models, but you pretty much can just scattershot, you know, throw a dart go into FLGS, throw a dart at the Sigmar side of the board, side of the room, and you've got a phenomenal model, like, to build your army in. It's just incredibly, incredibly amazing to see.
Well said. All right. Well, everybody, hope you had a great time listening and got to check us out on the stream if you did see any of the games or just wanted to kill some time while you're at work or whatever.
Yep.
We'll see you next week, everybody.
See you next week.
They said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.